I was born in the hospital in Yankton, Sacred Heart, in 1925, June 17th. And I guess lived in the area all my life, basically on the county lines, Yankton-Clay County line. I went in the Navy in 1944, came back, and started in farming about the same area that I grew up in. And I guess met Marianne in what year? 48. And anyway, she was going to go to school in Washington University in St. Louis. And how I met her was the fact that my dad and his twin brother and my mother and another neighbor had gone to Denmark, because my dad was going to visit his family over there where he grew up. And he came over here in 1914, and then he ended up in the American Army and ended up in Alsace Lorraine, Luxembourg, November 11th at 11 o'clock when they quit fighting. And he told me that, he says, you don't want to be in the Army. So when it came to my turn, well, I was going to join the Merchant Marine. And then be a Merchant Marine sailor, you had to be, you had to have a birth certificate. Well, the doctor that attended my mother when I was born in Yankton had not registered my birth until a year after I was born and spelled my name wrong. This was S-E-O-N instead of E-N, and they wouldn't accept it. Well, anyway, I took a Navy technician exam, and I ended up, I guess, about that time they drafted me, and I ended up in the Navy instead of the rest of the crew from Clay County ended up in the Army. And then I went aboard ship, and I guess I ended up on USS Winged Arrow, which was the ship you have the picture of. It's was kind of famous when I got on there. It had invaded the Philippine Islands, and then it went to Iwo Jima and a bunch of other islands, but they picked up the flag raisers that got to be famous on this Iwo Jima story and hauled them back to the States. And it was camouflaged, of course, and it was a rusty bucket by that time. And I thought, oh gosh, what did I get for a ship? But anyway, then I got aboard the thing, and then we ended up going to, I guess, we ended up at the lower end of Okinawa, a little called island called Aishima, which was this Ernie Pyle was the guy that wrote the books about that. And this little Aishima was a little bit of a, well, looked like a pile of rock sticking out of the ocean, about a mile high and about a half mile wide. And anyway, then I guess we had a, well, I guess on the way over there, we had a Jap sub on our tail there one night. But anyway, we got out of that one because the destroyer got the Jap and we got the heck out of there. But anyway, we got to Aishima, and they were digging these Japs out of the mountains. I could even remember as a metalsmith, I was looking off in the distance, and he happened to look up, and here's a bunch of men running around the side of this doggone mountain. And I thought, what the heck are they doing? And they stopped for a second, and they couldn't get these Japs to come out, so they stuck a flamethrower in the hole. And so I don't know what happened after that. I went back to whatever I was doing. But anyway, then we loaded up, I suppose, I think 1,800 or 2,000 of those prisoners, and hauled them back to Pearl Harbor. And then as it went on, we had, I guess we unloaded them. But the thing about it was, those prisoners, they didn't trust them in the fact that if they give them a rag, they'd commit suicide. So these Marines and guards that were drawn as a kind of a lottery to get the heck out of there, they were made these guys, as they came aboard, they were full of fleas and lice. So then, of course, they'd give them a haircut and disinfect them, and then they'd give them a salt water bath underneath a big old fire nozzle that was went about 14 feet, rigged over a boat, David. And anyway, then they'd put them down the cargo holds, but they didn't mistreat them. I never saw anyone ever, of course, the Japs couldn't understand the English anyway, but the thing about it was, if they put them down there, they'd feed them twice a day, never mistreated them, and they would give them, if they had fish, where they'd have some starchy foods to go along with it, or if they had meat, they had noodles or whatever, and anyway, they would take them out every day so they could get some sunshine, and it wasn't dark down there, they had lights down there, but anyway, they had places where they could have water and toilet, they didn't have running water there, but they had buckets and so forth, and anyway, if they took them out, chipped any paint, any rusty spots or anything, did any labor, then they would, and they did very little of that, they had some food for them, maybe a piece of bread with some meat or something on it, and if they wanted to smoke, they could have a cigarette, and then they could rest, and then they put them back down in, and there was a few of them that were wounded, and those were taken care of, too, in the fact that they had medical facilities rigged up, and I can remember they had an area there where they had I think even some younger Japanese that were with them, and they had them running errands between the medics and the this area where they had actually bunks for officers, where they were two bunks with big mattresses on them, and they would take care of them so that but anyway, I know some died because they'd come down as a metalsmith. Well, we had to have we always had some scrap metal, so when they buried them, why, they would not float, and I think we had about five of them, but anyway, they were never mistreated. And when we got rid of the prisoners, I remember there was a fellow that I was working on something as a metalsmith. What are you doing? So anyway, as I went by, our guy came by, and he was looking for somebody from South Dakota. And this shipmate knew I was from South Dakota. So anyway, he told this Marine, he said, oh, here's a guy from South Dakota. And then this guy latched on to me like a long-lost brother, and I had another buddy from Garden City, Harold Barkley, and him and I were on this anti-aircraft gun as crew members on there when we had to do this. And he'd come up, and when he wasn't guarding prisoners, he'd come up and sit with us. And he said that it was the third one of those he'd been in on invasions, and he said if he didn't get the heck out of there, he was going to get killed. So he would come and sit with us, but I never got his name. I never wrote his name down because I didn't have a pencil. I didn't carry a pencil, so I never wrote his name down. And then, of course, we got back to Pearl Harbor, and by golly, the world's pretty small. You can go halfway around the world. And here comes a guy that was a guy by the name of Pete List from Yankton. And I remember him from before he went into service. He run a furniture store and secondhand store, and he bought wool. And by golly, here he come. And he latched on to me, danged if I know, but anyway, I run into him. And so anyway, now I see his son once in a while at the VFW in Yankton on a Saturday night, or on a Friday night, rather, but anyway, it's kind of a small world, so anyway.
You had talked about your role as a metalsmith. What kind of things did that job description have for you?
Well, one crazy thing, one day we were in a typhoon, and I think that was probably the next trip we made. We're going across the Pacific, and anyway, as it went on, we got it run into the storm, And I made, I think, about 80 covers to cover up water valves so the master at arms could lock up the water, because we had a big evaporator to make the fresh water. Well, of course, the big old turbines that run the ship needed water first to keep the thing going, and of course the hospital and the kitchen needed fresh water to do the hospital and the cooking. Well, anyway, as it went on, I'd get these boils, and I don't know why I'd get a boil, but it was always hot and humid. And like I say, I we'd stand in line for half an hour to get wet, and then get back in line and get rinsed off, you know. And if you stayed under there too long, why, two guys that were bigger than you would sit you out of the way and you'd get in line. But anyway, when I get these boils, there was an Italian fellow, or his heritage, and he had more hair on his back than a grizzly bear. And he was a good medic. And when I'd come down there, he would get rid of my boils. Well, if I had come down there two, three times, then he said, well, the doc better see you. Well, anyway, the doc, I think, was from Minot. But anyway, he'd get a knife and he'd come out. I get a scar for every one of them. But anyway, one day we're in this storm, and all the watertight doors were shut all the time. When we were at sea, that was our shipfitter's job, to lock all these watertight doors on this. Actually, was a cargo ship, because they had converted it over to put these landing craft up on the main deck, and then they would put them in the water with these 60-ton booms, and then they'd run them over on the beach. Well, the story was, when they invaded the Philippines, they had run into the beach with these, and of course things were getting pretty hectic. So anyway, the program was that the ship better get out of there. So they left all these 20 boats on their cruise over there on the beach, and 2 days later they came back and picked them up. But anyway, I guess I'm changing my thought here a little bit, but anyway, getting back to this typhoon, this medic came back to the shipfitter shop across the top of the deck, hanging on these lines across the top of ship, because he couldn't come through it. And I said, what the heck are you doing back here? Well, he said, needed help. I said, well, what's the matter? Well, he said, this refrigerator down in the hospital, hospital, it broke loose, and it was a refrigerator like you'd have an ordinary house or whatever. And it had broke loose, and it was sliding back and forth. So I took a buddy that was weighed 2 1/4. We went down there, and I rigged a lead from the welder that was the closest one, and we had hundreds of feet of a welding lead. Got down there, and this thing was dancing back and forth in there, and these two guys, they got a hold of this thing, pushed it over about where it was supposed to be, or I guess where it was supposed to be, and hooked their toenails in the paint. And I welded a band around the doggone thing, and when the thing got done with that way, the thing leaned the right way, and he opened up the door, and there was nothing broken in there. And thank God that was the only thing. And talking about this typhoon, there was a Marine that was standing in line at the mess hall. And of course, I was about the only guy aboard ship that wore an Army cap, because you couldn't put an arc welding helmet over a Navy cap, you know. So anyway, as I went through this line there, this guy spotted me, and he said, it was a joint. This ship was riveted. It had some frames that were welded or riveted together. A lot of these Liberty ships were just welded, and they would break up in a storm. But this joint was big enough. I remember laying up in there and working on water lines and whatever. But anyway, it was squeaking like a rusty gate. And this Marine says to me, "What about that?" That's all he said. Well, I said, as long as it's squeaking, I wouldn't worry, but if it quits, I'd be doing something else about it when I had my meal, you know. But anyway, but we got through that thing all right. And when the storm was over, why, somebody said that we were been told that if it go to 32 degrees, it should capsize. Well, somebody said they were in the wheelhouse, it had an inclemeter hanging there, and it went to 39. So we didn't get to be fish bait that time, but anyway. So I think then we ended up, about that time they dropped atomic bomb, and we were headed for, I suppose, invasion. And the story was, we were told that if they would invaded Japan when this typhoon, there would have been more people lost from the storm than there would have been from the invasion. So anyway, then I guess we hauled troops out of, we did have a Jap prisoner jump overboard coming out of Saipan one time, I guess. But I think I've been about every island north of the equator. And then we ended up, I guess we hauled, went into Shanghai and Hong Kong. I think I was running anchor winch and we lost the anchor waiting for the Chinaman to take us up the river. And then we went to Korea. And I guess we were in Korea at Christmas after World War II. And I remember somebody was going to go get some mail from someplace. We were tied up to some oiler they drug in there, some Navy oiler. And that thing was, somebody had run into the side of that thing and had a dent in it. I remember that. And the deck of it was about the color of the black, just full of slime. But anyway, they wanted an axe and a saw so they could cut down a Christmas tree for Christmas. And I remember when they came back, why, they said that the streets of this village were filthy, that people would just do their business on the street. And so thank God we didn't have to go over and go through that mess anyway. But anyway, I guess talking about going in the up the Wangpu River, our shift hitter crew run the anchor detail, and I don't know why I got the job, but anyway, I run the winch. And I remember there was this Chinaman was supposed to take us up the river, because you like taking a big ship up a narrow river like Mississippi or whatever. And they was supposed to come 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and as it went on, he didn't show up. So the next morning, about 8 o'clock, here comes this little boat down the river, and we got orders to pull in the anchor, and we had a 90 fathom chain out, which would be times six. And boy, most of the time when you put the power to this old DC motor, why, the thing would struggle. And of course you had twice the depth of the water out in chain, you know. But anyway, boy, it rolled in just like you're going to roll in the fishing reel without the bait on it, you know. And I knew something was wrong when we got up to the swivel in the anchor chain. The pin had come out and the nut come off, and we'd lost the chain. And of course the links were big, huge things. They were, I don't know what they would weigh if you weighed them, you know, but they were 12, 15 feet or 15 inches long. So anyway, we got up in there, and then we had to turn around on the river. Remember that? And I remember there was a couple of tugboats that were going to turn us around. And you know, most people think about a tugboat being pretty good size with a big engine in it. Well, anyway, I think three of them came out to turn us around. And I remember looking over the side, and there were about like a fishing boat down there, and the smoke was coming out of the old thing. Well, I think we dropped the raise and lower the anchor about 10 times before we got turned around in there without running into something, and we got back out of there, you know. But, and I guess I did have a liberty in Hong Kong. And I remember the British Army was running on the wrong side of the road, on a different street. And the people there, actually, the people were working on the waterfront. Coming into Hong Kong, there was a freighter there that was, they were unloading bags of something or other onto a barge. And anyway, as it went on, they were getting this bags over on this barge. So when they were going to take the thing over to the beach, instead of taking a tugboat and pulling it in there, they had a tiller on the back of this barge, which would be a big long pole with like an oar. And then on the inboard of that, they had it attached to the deck. And then this line that attached to the inboard of this tiller that would, when they wanted to propel this thing, there would be three, four guys pushing on this, different from the tillers that were swinging it back and forth, and they'd propel that over to the beach. It took them half a day to get that thing. And the longshoremen that were working on the beach, they had a sandal on 1 foot, and they had rags on their back and patches on the rags. And the people that were living in, on these sampans in the river, actually were dipping water out of the bay and cooking their food, and the families were living on there. And the dirt from the ships, we didn't have any way to contain the sewage. It was dumped in there. Why those people didn't live, die, we would have if we had to live in that conditions, you know. So I guess I can understand why they changed from one government to another one, because they had nothing, you know. But the city of Hong Kong was modern, but the hotels and the streets, and but the money wasn't worth anything. The I remember one of my shipmates had changed some money on a street money changer, and there was a boy that was standing in front of a door, and this little boy was had a can, was begging for. So this shipmate went over and gave him some Chinese money, and he didn't even want it. It was that worthless. And so anyway, then we went on, and but the hotels were not much different than they were in the cities here. They were modern in Hong Kong. And I remember we went to a Chinese restaurant, but I remember when I got there, I needed to use a washroom, and I asked this Chinaman where the washroom was, and I went into the kitchen, and it would, if you can think of pictures that were big old stone, split stone, that's where they were doing the cooking on, and it was real medieval. But the dining room area was modern, but I can't eat Chinese food yet today. So anyway, enough stories.
Can you tell me where you were and how you found out that Pearl Harbor had been bombed and the U.S. was going to war?
Oh, I was sitting, okay, my dad and mom had been farming and feeding cattle with an old aunt and uncle, and they had their own farm. And this old great aunt and old great uncle that were family on both sides. And my old aunt had started out as an immigrant, and they had done well. And in their lifetime, they had bought a couple of farms, and they had built a nice big house, had a furnace in it. They had their own light plant and the whole thing. And anyway, as it went on, one night my old great aunt was going to get up and went. They had running water, but they didn't have rural water, so the water they had in the bathroom was cistern water, and she wanted a drink of water, so she went downstairs to get this glass of water from the fresh water that they had a well not too far from the house, but it wasn't piped in the house, and she fell down the stairway, and anyway, as it went on, she got a bad bump, and they put her in the hospital, and they kept her in there for about 5 days, and she was ready to come home. My uncle had a couple of hired men, and they were going to get done harvesting, and so anyway, she wanted him to come up. My gosh, she had a blood clot and died. Well, anyway, he had been a hunter and a fisherman, but anyway, living along the Missouri River, after she passed away, one day my dad went up, I guess the next Sunday went up, and he gave his shotgun, a Krupp double barrel shotgun and a 25-20 to my dad, and told him to take it home. So I went home and I told my mother, I'm going to go stay with him because this wasn't a good situation. So I went up there and sat with him, and I was there for some months, and the Japs went into Pearl Harbor. And I was sitting there in his den. He had a den with a couple of big leather chairs and a big 12-tube radio that we still own. And he had that turned on, and the reason I was bored, because I was a trumpet player, and he couldn't stand music anymore, so had the radio on, and the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor, and I was sitting there. And then, of course, I later on went in the Navy, and and he died when I was aboard ship.
You had said that you had planned on a career in the Merchant Marines. Why were you attracted to that branch?
Well, my dad told me you don't want to be in the Army. And everybody in the area were being drafted. We had a neighbor that was one of the first neighbors that ended up over in North Africa. And I guess we had another friend that was from over in Ponca, Nebraska, and he had been drafted in the Army, and he told me that he had an opportunity to go to server school, but he was so doggone lonesome, he went home on a furlough, and they shipped him over to the Philippines, and the second day he got killed. And so I had decided that I'm going to stay away from that for a while. And then, of course, then I ended up in the Navy, and I guess I never got a grade on the exam I took, but the guys that went to be drafted the same time I did, they all end up in the Army, and the other two guys that took this test with me, we ended up in the Navy. And then I guess about that time they were sending everybody aboard ship, basically, if you didn't have a special, I don't know, whatever, but I didn't go to service school. And when I got aboard ship, I didn't get any special education. What I learned as far as the metalsmiths was concerned, I got in the shipfitter gang, and a couple Irishmen were in there, and they taught me how to weld in three easy lessons, and about two, I was a welder and went on from there. So that was the end of my education, was the seat of his pants, I guess.
So were there some stories about, metalsmithing, I suppose? I know you talked about a couple when you were on ship and were discussing the rivets and that kind of thing. So what sort of things would you do as far as ship repair? Or were there things that you just kind of had to jury-rig because they needed to be done and you had to think on your feet?
That's exactly right. There was no instruction books. There was a pilot welding rod 20 feet long and 50-pound boxes. And there wasn't even a chart to tell you what they were. You had to read the end of the box and figure out what it was. And we made jewelry out of stainless steel. And somebody said, you can't do that. Well, we did it anyway. And we would take a piece of 3/16 steel and cut it in little bands about 3/8 of an inch wide and make little letter H's out of them and then make some little narrow strips. And we would bore through the edges of them with a hand drill. And we would use hard silver solder for rivets. We'd bend the backs of those things. And a buddy of mine, I got into the shipfitter gang, one day he was digging around and he cut a piece of that metal big enough to cover up an old GI buckle. And he said to me, he put my name on there, my ship's name and my serial number, and went around the edge of this with a small letter O with a stamp, and stamped it all by hand and curved it. And he said, put that on your old buckle. Well, my buckle was rusty because, of course, being in the South Pacific, what you do, you sweat all the time. And this old steel buckle, the paint came off, and the work buckle. And so anyway, I thought, well, what am I going to do with this old piece of stainless steel and a piece of rusty metal? So I went and got some silver solder. And I sweat that on there with a gas torch. Well, I started wearing it. And so anyway, guys would say, well, where'd you get this? Well, anyway, as it went on, I told him this Martin Chagosky made it. And he had orders for 30 of them. So I said to Martin, I got to do it a different way. So I kept scrounging around and I found some real small, real thin, low hydrogen rod. And anyway, I welded them on with that. And he'd sell them for $3 a piece. And then we'd start making these bracelets. Well, we got 25 for them, I think, because that'd take a long time to make each one of these. Well, as it went on, then I guess one day we were, well, of course, our home port was San Jose, Frisco area. And then we'd go into, if we hauled troops, Army, we'd have to go into Seattle to haul the guys we hauled back. And if we had to have more Army, we'd have to load it at Seattle. So then we would get into Bremerton Navy Yard, and of course we'd have to get dry dock to get rid of the barnacles, you know, because that was just like driving an old ship with the brakes on. Well, we were in Bremerton Yard, and they had a great big machine shop of all kinds. And so anyway, I guess I went over to one of these metal shops. I went in there, and this place was huge, of course. And I got in there, and I said to this guy, how about cutting me some pieces of stainless? Yeah, he said, that guy over there, he's the foreman. He said, you get out of here. He said, I'll cut it for you, and then I'll throw it down along the wall here, whatever, and you come back and pick it up. So anyway, then we really got into business because we had some real easy way to do it then, see? And then if we didn't have any square tubing, the lumber that our carpenters had, I think they'd fish that out of the bay over in the Philippines because it was full of knots and crooked and wet. And then, we had plywood to repair the bottoms of those LCVPs. They were the small ones, and the LCMs were all steel. But anyway, when it come to metal, we didn't have any. The only tubing we had was a steel pipe, and it was galvanized. So anytime we had to build something, we had to make it out of pipe or flat stuff or whatever. And we improvised all the time, you know. And if you welded on that galvanized, well, then you'd get sick from the smoke that came off from it. So we have a guy or two once in a while would wake up in the middle of the night vomiting because he had too much of that. And of course, you get down in the bowels of the ship, there was no place to suck the fumes out, you know. So if you were down below deck and they had orders from up above, why? And you didn't hear them, why then, of course, you got in trouble because one day I guess I was down below deck and we had piped our bedding out to get it aired out, because when you're living in a compartment where there's 100 guys, I mean, there's 8 bunks on 2 pipes, you know, and you're just elbow to elbow. And in fact, you couldn't turn over in your bunk, because if you did, you were pumping the other guy above you, you know, but the heavier he was, the more space he took, you know. But anyway, this particular day, why, I was got up and I got out of the wherever it was, and my name was on the list for extra duty to paint the brig, because I hadn't got my bedding taken in and nobody came down and told me. Well, they wouldn't listen to an excuse like that. And so anyway, the brig was up in the bow of the ship, about 30 feet below the main deck. And I went down and painted that thing. And a guy that had a bunk next to by the name of George Doty was a good old egg from Spokane. And anyway, as it went on, a guy that was aboard ship had been on one of the first trip had been made, and they came back luckily. So he asked for special liberty to go home and see his mom, and he all lived 90 miles from Frisco. Well, about 90% of them lived in Indiana and Iowa and Minnesota and North Dakota and Kansas and Nebraska and South Dakota. We could have taken his extra duty, you know, was that duty, you know, even if he went for an hour extra. But anyway, they put him, restricted him, so every 4 hours, why, they'd have to count noses because these guys had done X, Y, Z. Next trip, why, he asked for special liberty when he got into States. You got to work. So he went home anyway, but anyway, he's on the list again. Well, about the third or fourth time, why, we got a new executive officer, and he said that this guy was spoiling the morale of the crew. So he gave him a court-martial. He broke him from the pay grade of a corporal down to a private and gave him 30 days in the brig on piss and punkin, which was one square meal and every 3 days, bread and water. So old George, he got the rotten duty to guard this guy. And of course, he had to sit outside this brig, which was about pointed and narrow, back about 7 feet. And it had one door in it with a hole in the door up above. There was some 3 little bars on this 12 by 12 hole. And then he'd take the bunk away from this guy. Well, anyway, the guy, this old ship was a pitching. going up and down just like an elevator, and the guy got the dry heaves with it. He didn't have anything in his stomach. So George, he smuggled him a piece of meat in his shirt pocket, and they caught him, and he got 5 days in the brig. So they talk about these guys in the clink that are being mistreated. They wouldn't want to give Gerald Jepson and George Doty the jury duty, because we'd put him out in a rock pile with a big hammer and bread and water. So anyway, that's enough of that.
Were there ever times as a metalsmith, or really in any of your Navy experiences, where you were actually in serious danger? A
couple times. Well, not as metalsmith, no. But our ship was. Well, I guess we were on our way across the Pacific in a convoy, and we were, when wartime, we were always in convoys, because they, you see, a transport with all these Marines on and all these other people, we need protection. We were never looking for trouble. We were never wanted to get into battle. We always wanted to get to cover up and hide, because we had a couple thousand passengers plus our crew of 465 feet of men. You know, if we were looking for trouble, look at all the lives would be lost. But anyway, one night I remember I was going to write a letter to Mom. And what can you write when you're in the middle of the Pacific? And if you do write anything, they'll cut it out anyway. So anyway, as it went on, I put my stuff back in my locker. And anyway, as it went on, I guess I had to go on gun watch. So anyway, I was loading this anti-aircraft gun. And we were on it 8 hours on and 4 hours off when the water was dangerous. And normally we'd be 4 and 8, but you didn't get much rest, I'll tell you. By the time you got somebody else relieved and got the other work done, you didn't spend any, and you didn't take your clothes off. But anyway, we always had a dry place and food to eat. But anyway, all of a sudden I heard a loud explosion. And of course, we all run up the main deck because we were going to go to the guns anyway. And here was a destroyer. There was, I think, four transports with Marines or whatever in ships just like ours, headed zigzag. We were going 8 knots, zigzag. So we didn't move forward very fast, and there was one Australian freighter behind us. And we had, I think, three destroyers. And these were small warships, you know, that could move real fast. And one of them was dropping depth charges on a Jap submarine, we thought, 300 yards away, and another one was coming back to help him, and we got the blankety blank out of there. And anyway, that they saved their neck, but they had sonar, see, they could measure underwater, and we had radar for surface and air, so we had no idea that was going on, see. So anyway, we got out of there that particular time. And then of course we had some floating mines once in a while. I can remember a time or two, there were some of them that were floating in the water, and they tried to sink them. I don't think they ever exploded any of them, but they did sink some by just shooting at them with anti-aircraft guns. And that would be like a bullet that would be, I suppose, what, inch and a quarter, inch and a half in diameter, and the bullet would probably be a foot long, something like that. And I was loader on one of them. The guy that was our gunner, he was a tall guy from Tennessee by the name of Glegley. And man, he could fire that thing. I mean, if every fifth round was a tracer. So if the sight setter didn't have fancy equipment like they have today, you know, and he just kind of followed the target with this tracer, and he just like a guy with a fire hose, he'd take her and bring her over there. But all he had to do was put some more brackets up there and knock the empties off. And I think every third or fourth magazine, I'd have to take that hot barrel and take it out and stick it in a sleeve and put a cold one in there. So anyway, I guess he must have thought some farm kid that could scoop snow and corn to a cattle, why he could handle that heavy weight. So anyway, but
what was your experience like the day you found out the war ended? And where were you, and how did you find out so on?
You know, I don't know. We were out at sea. And when you're out at sea, you know, all there is some more water. So there's no markers or anything. But anyway.
How did you find out?
Well, I suppose they broadcast it over the PA system. They had radio men aboard, of course, that would keep in contact with messages. And I suppose they told the commander about it. And I suppose he gave orders to pass it over the PA system. But I suppose that's how we heard it. And I can't just remember any details about it.
Sure. What was life like for you when you got back home and you were out of the service?
Oh, I guess I was going to go to school, and I had a GI Bill, of course, that I could have gone to for 4 years, but I couldn't find a place to stay. And they didn't have dormitories and places like that for us. And by the time I got home, see, being part of this crew of this ship that had to haul all these people home, it was a lot of these people. Okay, for instance, if you were a married man and had children, see, as soon as the war got over, well, then, of course, they had a list of people that were going to be discharged first, see. So if you had a wife and some kids, well, you were on the top of the list, see. And if you had, say, a couple of years in or whatever, you were at the top of the list, see. So those guys, they actually ended up coming home first. And so by the time I got home, well, the state college was where I was going to go, and they didn't have any places for single men to live. And I went up there, and I guess a friend of mine, he found a place to sleep in somebody's basement. And my dad should have told me, or my mom, to go up there and live in a tent or something. I didn't have a car because I had sold that to somebody else. And I guess dad didn't have two cars, and he had an old farm truck that if you were going to drive it to a local town, that would be as far as you wanted to go with it, you know. But so that's why I didn't go to school. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I started in farming and feeding cattle and did that and still doing it. So,
how do you think your experience changed you or changed the direction of the rest of your life?
Yeah, I don't think it changed it any. I think the thing I always regret that I didn't go to school. And I have four kids, and we sent them all to school and paid their tuition. And I guess I was kind of a music nut, and the fact that when I was a kid, I played a bugle when I was 9, and I played a trumpet in a high school band and a dance band. And I guess I ended up singing a Navy choir when I was a recruit on national broadcasting with one of these guys I went in the Navy with. And I guess the only regret I have is I didn't continue to play the trumpet because the chaplain we had aboard ship really didn't do anything for the crew. When Sunday came along, we didn't go to church because we were so tired that if you didn't have the duty, you didn't get up. And if somebody went to the breakfast on Sunday morning, which was the best breakfast of the week, and they come back and told you what it was, you had to be awful hungry to get out of that bed if you were sleeping and go eat. And the chaplain, I had a trumpet, and I said to him one day, I said, could I check out the trumpet? Yep, you're going to have it. I said, well, how long can I keep it? And he said, you got to bring it back tomorrow. Well, we had water rationing, so we had to have fresh water to wash out this trumpet that somebody else had played, and he kept it. And nobody played it for 2 years. And we had one guy that we got that was what we called him a painter. He was part of our shipfitter crew. He'd issue paint and so forth to whoever needed it. And I remember him and the fact that he got a hold of clarinet, and one day he was sitting in his paint locker and he was playing this clarinet. And I don't know whether it was good, bad, or otherwise, but I can remember the goofy things that some couple of carpenters snuck out of a little old carpenter shop. It was probably 1/4 of this room, and they snuck over there and put the hasp on this lock so he couldn't get out. Well, he was playing on this doggone thing, I remember that. And pretty soon he discovered it was time to pass out some more paint, and couldn't get out. Well, anyway, we were beating on the door, and of course, I wasn't going to get involved with this doggone thing. I watched the whole thing. And anyway, they discovered he calmed down, and he went and opened the dumpster to get out. He looked at me across the area there, and I was doing my metal work, and he knew I wasn't guilty then, see. But anyway, but I had, that was one regret that I didn't, wasn't able to play the trumpet because I quit playing it, and I still got my trumpet, and I've got some Glenn Miller dance music, and I haven't played any of it. And I don't think I can play Taps if the Party Died Now, so.
Have you had a chance to keep up with anyone that you were served
Oh,
with?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You go to a lot of the reunions?
Well, we had 25 of them or so, and we just quit having them because our crew is falling apart, and Marianne has been talking to some of them, writing some notes, and when are we never getting a response back because we're all getting to be a bunch of old whatever you call them. And anyway.
Excuse me just one second, please.
I talk to one of them on a regular basis about once a month, and he was a storekeeper aboard our ship, and he was the guy that kept track of all the supplies that came aboard and as we issued out. And then about a month ago, we went and saw one of them on the way over in Wisconsin to see an old aunt of Marianne's, and then we went to Duluth to granddaughter for dinner, and then we went to another shipmate that's up at Roseau, Minnesota, and he was one of these kind of guys that went, when we'd have our ship reunion, he'd bring this bosun pipe along, which a bosun aboard ship is the guy that goes, and he's the basically like the sergeant in charge, duty sergeant, and the officer of the deck would give him orders to pipe over the PA system with this little pipe he puts over his hand, and then there's different sounds that go on there, and we as crew member knew what these calls were, and then we'd pay attention, and then he would give the order. And we did see him, but he had an operation a few years ago, and by golly, when he had that operation, he couldn't remember. Now he's getting to the point where he can't remember at all. So we did see him. And I guess we talked to a couple of shipmates' wives that have been coming to reunions for years. And could we kind of keep track of some of them? They call us once in a while. And so, anyway, we had a real good group and had a lot of fun doing it.